In America, we used to say, I may not believe what you believe, but I will die defending your right to express it.
The war that we're seeing waged abroad also has a parallel in the United States, a vicious war on the people of the United States.
We cannot really accept lessons on morality about the nature of the regime. We have paid too high a price.
I'd have to give this president a failing grade and then some for his economic plan, but I'd give him a passing grade for rhetoric.
When the United States Senate voted to extend relatively undefined war powers to President Bush, that marked the end of the American Republic and the beginning of the American Empire.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, January 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Peace activists held a press conference in the nation's capital this afternoon to announce plans for massive nationwide anti-war protests on January 18th. The mobilizations are planned about a week before Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is due to report back to the Security Council on Iraq's weapons capabilities. According to organizers, an estimated 200,000 people will gather in Washington, as well as 100,000 in San Francisco, to voice their opposition to the proposed war on Iraq. Among the speakers at today's press conference was Brian Becker, a coordinator of the activist group ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism.
We believe that the trigger for this war will be the January 27th UN report to the Security Council. In spite of the fact that there appears to be ample and thorough cooperation between the Iraqi authorities and the UN weapons inspectors, we know and the world knows that this resolution was not really designed to carry out disarmament, but was established as a diplomatic fig leaf and a trigger for war. And that war is coming unless the people of this country and the people around the world come together and become a potent political anti-war force so powerful that it can stay the hand of the administration. And that's what we're planning when tens of thousands and perhaps hundreds of thousands of people demonstrate on January 18th in Washington, D.C. Damu Smith from the Black Voices for Peace.
I want to remind everyone of the fact that there is indeed a black community concerned about this war. We died disproportionately in the war in Vietnam, and we, along with other people of color and marginalized people in the United States, will suffer greatly as a result of the domestic consequences of this war. Because it has been, as has been stated, there will be massive cutbacks for the foreseeable future in essential human needs and social service programs in order to finance the warfare state being created by George Bush and his administration. And we've been watching the footage of families saying goodbye to their loved ones. We've seen people of all races saying goodbye to their husbands and their wives and their children. But as we have watched, we are reminded of the fact that our community is greatly represented in those who have been sent off to fight.
Our next speaker will be Peta Lindsay, a freshman at Howard University, the student and youth coordinator for the ANSWER Coalition.
On the buses traveling from all across the country to this demonstration will be anti-war activists, labor unionists, members of various religious communities, longtime fighters for civil and women's rights, as well as those who have never before been to a demonstration. But undoubtedly, of those tens of thousands, the bulk of the participants of the January 18th demonstration will be youth and students. And so the youth and students of the ANSWER Coalition have decided that in addition to mobilizing for the mass demonstration on Saturday, we will be holding a separate youth and student action on Sunday, January 19th. This youth and student action will be beginning at the Department of Injustice at 11 a.m. to protest the government-sponsored persecution of Arab, Muslim, and international communities, including the recent mass arrests in California and other violations of their rights that have been taking place all across this country. We feel that many of these violations are taking place within our own schools, as more and more universities are complying with the FBI and the INS investigations and supplying them with the private information of Arab, Muslim, international students. And so it is our job to stand up to the racist witch hunt and defend our brothers and sisters in the streets of D.C. on the 19th and on our campuses in the months to come.
Our next speaker is Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. She is the co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice and a member of the Answer Coalition Steering Committee.
It's a question right now of whether or not people are going to restrain this government and other governments from taking actions that are uniformly opposed by people around the world. The Bush administration has said that they want to wage a war against Iraq, a preemptive war. They have threatened nuclear war against countries all around the world. Their nuclear posture review, their security strategy states that they believe they have the right to wage nuclear war against non-nuclear countries. This is terrorizing. And they're saying that they're going to go to Iraq because they have the right to go to Iraq, because they have the right to set up military occupation of another country. And when they go to Iraq, will they end with Iraq? They won't. People in the United States are looking this week at news reports of soldiers being shipped off. And people are asking why. It's clear that there is no reason for soldiers to be sent away from this country. And we all know that they will not all come back. And the war that we're seeing waged abroad also has a parallel in the United States, a vicious war on the people of the United States that's being led by George Bush and John Ashcroft against people throughout the United States, with frightening and terrorizing detentions and raids, with people being swept off streets, with people being forced to register, and when they go in to comply, being put in handcuffs. It's a shame on this country, and it's a shame on this government. And people all around the U.S. are coming to D.C. on January 18th because they are going to put an end to this. This is not the way that this country will operate.
Our next speaker perhaps needs no introduction, but I'll give one nonetheless. Ramsey Clark was the Attorney General during the Johnson administration from 1966 to 1969.
10 days from now, on January the 18th, may be the last real opportunity the American people have to stand up and stand out and come out and say no to this war. And for those of us who fail to do so, we'll have to expect the rest of the world to assume that the American people were either so wanting in compassion or so powerless that they supported or condoned a war of aggression against them that has threatened the use of nuclear weapons. January the 18th is the day of the people of the United States to say no to this war. If we owe anything to the memory of Martin Luther King, and we owe a great, great deal, is to stand up now. And his birthday weekend is a perfect time, January the 18th, to say no war, Mr. President. It's been now since 1967 that Dr. King said, the greatest purveyor of violence on earth is my own government. He never uttered words that hurt him more to say. On the eve of his birthday, we see the United States sending tens of thousands of heavily armed troops with enormous technological capacities to kill. It's President Bush who's a threat to the peace in the world.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and other peace activists announcing plans for nationwide anti-war protest on January 18th. Thanks to Peace Watch reporter Josh Chaffin for preparing that segment. Debate was fierce at times in the House of Representatives today as members of Congress discussed President Bush's proposed economic stimulus package. The plan would give $364 billion in tax breaks to investors in the stock market in an attempt to boost the faltering economy. Critics charge, however, that it would do little to benefit average Americans, especially while social services are being cut as the U.S. prepares to launch attacks on Iraq. Representative Jim McDermott, a Democrat from Washington.
If you think that's a stimulus to the economy, you don't understand ordinary people. So you are wasting $700 billion. You are taking us into a senseless war, and you won't take care of people who are sitting in your own districts. You say, well, we have the budget, you know. We have to keep the budget in balance. You gave that up, and you're going to give it up. The president says we're having a wartime budget. So in a wartime budget, you don't have to worry about what's going on. You can just spend money on all kinds of things, but not on the unemployed.
U.S. Representative Jim McDermott of Washington. According to author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux, Bush's stimulus package is seriously lacking.
It seems to me that the president has completely ignored a domestic public policy agenda and has, in fact, hidden his class bias behind tax cutting. For example, he spent a very large amount of time talking about eliminating the tax on dividends as if this is one of our nation's most pressing economic problems. But in fact, when you look at a tax on dividends, more than half of all Americans don't own stock. Most people who do own it or hold it in their 401ks or another kind of retirement programs, so they're exempt from this. You're looking at perhaps 15-20% of the most wealthy Americans when you talk about this.
How is eliminating dividend taxes going to boost the economy? Is the theory there that those people will spend that money that they save and sort of lift all the boats?
Actually, the theory in eliminating a dividend tax is that you'd make investment in stocks and bonds, especially in stocks, more attractive so that if you were going to get a higher rate of return, you might choose to invest there rather than to invest in something else. The problem with that, again, of course, is that most people are not investing in stock. Most people are investing in their retirement funds, and half of all Americans have no investment at all. This entire thing that President Bush has put forward really does speak to the wealthy. He wants to accelerate any number of tax cuts that were passed in 2001. And at the same time, the sugar that he offers is a $400 per child tax credit, an increase in that, which actually is a good thing. It's a little bit more than the Democrats offer. They offer $300 per taxpayer. So he's offering a little bit more there, but when you look at the way that it's offered, it doesn't provide enough. The most important thing that we have to bear in mind here is that we expect to see massive spending on a war effort, whether it's just toward Iraq and Korea. And let's not forget our efforts in Afghanistan. We've seen this president and his administration lay out any number of things that they want to do, secure the oil fields in Iraq, the oil fields, but not the people. I find that a little amusing.
How much exactly is Bush's defense budget for this year? I think it was predicted to be around $396 billion, estimated.
It's estimated at around, nearly $400 billion, and that, quite frankly, doesn't deal with the cost of war. This is the steady-state defense budget, and we would look at more money, especially if we were talking about long-term in Iraq. And already this week, we've seen a proposal for a long-term involvement in Iraq. So we might be talking, billions more. In fact, late last year, Yale professor William Nordis suggested that we might be looking at as much as $1 trillion in Iraq if we were talking about a multi-year involvement there.
That would be long-term, actually. And so the president's stimulus package includes a sort of a 15% stimulus piece. But is it possible, Dr. Malveaux, that the cost of the war itself could actually shrink or neutralize whatever positive stimulating effects that Bush's plan might have on the overall economy?
Well, first we have to establish that there would be a stimulus from this plan, and I think that that's very questionable. Secondly, certainly the cost of war could eliminate any potential stimulus that exists. What he's done is he's behaved as if the domestic economy exists in a vacuum and as if there are no international reverberations of the other things that he's doing, especially vis-a-vis Iraq and vis-a-vis Afghanistan. And so when you begin to cost those things in, what you end up with is a much greater deficit and perhaps a greater economic drag in a year or two.
Now, is war generally historically proven to be good for the economy or bad for the economy? I mean, we're currently witnessing how just the threat of going to war is having a dampening effect on the economy. Consumer spending over the holidays was far less than the merchants had hoped for or even needed.
If war is connected to manufacturing increases and employment increases, then technically, in Keynesian terms, it's good for the economy. In other words, we're fighting a war, we have to manufacture more bullets, more guns, more whatever. That could have a stimulative effect on the economy. We're not fighting a 1965 war, though. This is a 21st century war, so it's not so clear that that kind of manufacturing has to take place. So the question about whether or not war has a positive effect on the economy is one that will have to be answered again in the 21st century. In addition, there are many, many indicators that suggest that war may have a deleterious effect on the economy. We've already, the war anxiety, the notion of what's going to happen, what are the impacts, what are the effects, we're playing that out now. So it is very likely that the uncertainty, especially of a 2-to-3 front war, which we're looking at, could drag the economy as opposed to bolster it.
And what about the oil factor here? There's so much anticipation of possible short-term benefits from possible access to Saddam Hussein or Iraq's oil wells. But what about over the long haul? Will this war boost or drain the economy given the oil factor?
The war could potentially increase the supply for oil, and the questions would be from a moral perspective whether or not the rest of the world would go along with our notion of protecting Iraqi oil fields. Certainly, the whole issue of energy supply is one that we've been dealing with since 1973. We've been dealing with the question of how the United States uses energy and how we can be fuel efficient. There is a supply of oil in Iraq, and you would have to be a fool to say that this was not at least one factor that's driving us in this war. How we get control of that supply, how that supply plays on the world market, really depends on the greater political issues of how we interact with Iraq. So I would not say that we would see an immediate improvement in our energy efficiency because we had access to Iraqi oil.
And finally, Dr. Malvo, what kind of domestic programs are going to end up being the first casualties of any war that we have with Iraq?
Well, all domestic programs are at risk because not only of a war with Iraq, but also because of the White House's notion of shrinking federal spending. We can look at our higher education infrastructure, talk about the higher education reauthorization that should come out of Congress this year and whether or not Pell Grant sizes will go up or go down, and one might say with limited funds go down. We can talk about the urban situation, whether or not monies will go into urban areas as well as into urban public schools. We can look at the fact that we've ignored completely, with rising unemployment, any kind of job training initiatives. We just haven't seen them this time around. Ordinarily, with a 15% increase in unemployment, which we've seen in the last year, you'd see the Labor Department say, what are we going to do about it? They've been notably silent. So I think the whole notion of a robust domestic economy is something that Democrats, progressives, and others will have to look at as we look at the ways that this president hopes to stimulate the economy by moving from the public sector to the private sector, and in the private sector only to the top 20%.
If you had to grade this president's plan, what would it be?
F-. And, you know, I don't mean to be harsh. I think that when you look at President Bush and the way that he has approached the domestic economy as well as the way that he's approached economic realities, there's a fair amount of myopia here. The bottom half of earners are simply ignored. Democrats have come through just a little bit better, but they basically have allowed conservatives to take the rhetorical high ground in talking about who deserves tax cuts. We don't need necessarily tax cuts. What we need are infusions of spending in underserved areas, including those who are unemployed, including those who are homeless. This is a word you haven't heard in a while, homeless, but it still exists. And so I'd have to give this president a failing grade and then some for his economic plan, but I'd give him a passing grade for rhetoric. And so, again, while we see a president who gets excited about cutting the dividends on stocks and bonds, let's look at an average American family, two people, both working, two children, and an income of about $50,000. Where's the relief for them? It isn't there.
Author and economist Dr. Julianne Malvo. Her most recent book is The Paradox of Loyalty, an African-American Response to the War on Terrorism. Yesterday, Peace Watch spoke with author and political satirist Paul Krasner, who has been provoking and titillating us for decades with his humor. He was the editor of the Lenny Bruce biography, editor of Hustler magazine, and for 42 years, publisher of The Realist, an underground satirical magazine. His new book, Murder at the Conspiracy Convention and Other American Absurdities, offers laughs at subjects that are not generally funny. According to Krasner, news commentator Harry Reasoner once said there were two persons whose hands he would not shake, Paul Krasner's and Senator Joe McCarthy. We open with his latest CD, Irony Lives.
So the whole thing has changed since September 11th, and everybody is obsessed with how it's going to change. Is it going to be the same? Is it going to be the same with changes? And the best question of all, I think, came from Larry King. He asked Bill Maher, you know, when will it be okay to be funny again? 1 month? 2 months? You know, as if there was a certain day that things could change. And so everybody was concerned. Jay Leno had a meeting on top of the mountain with Johnny Carson. What am I going to do? What kind of joke? I don't know what to do. Johnny Carson just said, Jay, revert to Bill Clinton adultery jokes. And that's what he did, and it worked. Demonize Osama bin Laden and you'll be okay. So, you know, you keep wondering, what are they going to say next? Is it too soon to do this? Is it too soon to do that? The question comes up, why did the U.S. government give $43 million of our taxpayers' money to the Taliban? And they didn't even have to show a business plan. All right, we'll stop with the poppies, okay? The reason the U.S. government gave $43 million to the Taliban was because they're a faith-based organization. You know, you want to ask these guys, why did they drop bombs in Afghanistan simultaneously with dropping crates of food? Because they figure that that's compassionate conservatism. And then, you know, why did they put the crates marked in English, French, and Spanish over Afghanistan? You know, oh, well, they can't read anyway. They can find a rationale for anything. And so Bush made it seem like a gang war. You know, you're either on our side or you're with the terrorists. Are you with the Crips or the Bloods? And then they would say that to the countries. Are you with us or against us? And Pakistan wasn't sure. And it was sort of like that old Jack Benny classic where the robber says, your money or your life. And in this case, it was Pakistan saying, we're thinking. And so this has been a war where shopping was the answer. That patriotism is just another word for consumerism. And as opposed to World War II, where they had rationing, now you're supposed to go max out your credit cards if you want to be considered a true American. All of the talk show hosts began to have, instead of the usual people plugging their movies or their TV shows, they would have on newscasters, anchors, pundits, discussing serious things. So that's why Dan Rather went on David Letterman, and he was reading the lyrics from America the Beautiful when he started sobbing uncontrollably. And David Letterman clasped his hand and said, it's okay. And Dan Rather, between sobs, said, no, I'm a professional. I shouldn't be doing this. And I remember Letterman's exact response. He said, oh, man, you are a professional, but good Christ, you're also a human being. And the audience applauded wildly, you know, because it's good to know who you are. I mean, we're all human beings, but how often do we get applauded for it?
Comedian Paul Krasner, author of Murder at the Conspiracy Convention and Other American Absurdities. Welcome, Paul.
Hi.
To Peace Watch. Paul, you've been called a lot of things by a lot of people. You've been called by the FBI an unconfined nut.
An unconfined raving nut.
Did you take that as a compliment?
Well, coming from them, yes. But, you know, it reminded me of what they used to do in the Soviet Union. For dissidents, they would paint an image of them as being crazy. And so there was a parallel to that. But, I mean, that was just character assassination, which my reputation can't be hurt because I'm so bad already to begin with. But the year after that was scary. They put out, the FBI secretly put out a leaflet with a swastika on it that had photographs of four individuals in each of the blank squares. One was of Abby Hoffman from the Yippies, and one of Jerry Rubin from the Yippies, Mark Rudd from Students for Democratic Society, and myself. And it had headlines like lampshades. And the copy read that these four individuals were Jewish and were threatening the black community, and their elimination would not be inappropriate. And this was approved by J. Edgar Hoover's two assistants, Carter DeLoach and William Sullivan. So, you know, if that got in the hands of some incensed black militant, it could have had dangerous results. But the Washington office approved this from the New York office and said that make sure that this leaflet, which talks about the facetious suggestion of the elimination of these leaders. And so it's like they had covered their butt by saying, you know, well, if any of us, four of us, got assassinated, they'd say, well, we said it was facetious. But it just shows once you open the gates of that kind of counterintelligence by an official agency, a taxpayer's money, they get addicted to it and go further and further.
Have you ever been called a patriot?
Joseph Heller called me a patriot. Kurt Vonnegut called me a patriot. And, you know, those are honorable sources.
What about un-American?
By people who said I should go back to where I came from, which was Brooklyn. I understood that, you know, they were, in a sense, brainwashed by the culture. And you see a lot of brainwashing done now by propaganda in the guise of public relations.
Well, on your most recent CD, Paul Krasner, Irony Lives, you talk about the censoring of TV talk show host Bill Maher of Politically Incorrect. And you really force us to laugh at something that most of us, the civil libertarian side of us, feel is not the least bit funny. Do you consider it to be part of your mission as a comedian living in the year 2003 with the Bush administration marching us headlong into war against the people of Iraq? Is it part of your mission, Paul Krasner, to find a way to help us through these anxieties with a little levity from time to time?
I really appreciate that question. Yeah, I think the deeper the repression becomes, the more need there is for irreverence toward the authority that brings it on, definitely. It's a kind of Aikido, you know, a martial art where you turn negative energy into positive.
It sounds like you have sort of a lifetime of that. You've sort of perfected that capability, that technique.
It's like my spiritual quest is to find the humor in horror because where there's humor, there's hope. And for me, that's the bottom line.
Your life story has been very colorful reading, to say the least. You were once the editor of the underground magazine, The Realist. You edited Hustler magazine. You ran an abortion referral service when it was illegal to do so. You've also edited 10 books and been a radio and TV commentator and host. Which of those would you say had the most impact on you in terms of shaping the Paul Krasner that we hear before us today?
They're all intertwined, but I think that publishing The Realist, starting in 1958, and then the last issue was in 2001, because there was no satire magazine for adults then, and I had no role models. I had just to make it up as I went along, and it served as a vehicle for people who were in the counterculture before there was even such a word, and so it was a real interactive process because I was in the position of being both a influenced by the counterculture and an influencer of it in terms of the kind of material that I published. And in the process, I was privileged to meet people and interview them and become friends with people like Ken Kesey and Tim Leary and Ram Dass and Jerry Garcia. And provided an opportunity for me. It was an incredible education because, to start with, I knew that I couldn't be the only Martian on the block. And when I did my first show at Town Hall in New York, it was for the readers of The Realist, I had never seen an audience look each other over like that. It was like a Martian convention. And so it was really a delightful privilege to be in that position.
If you had an opportunity to speak to President George Bush in the White House, just you and George Bush one-on-one, how do you think that conversation might go?
Oh, boy. That's such a hard question, you know, and I've thought about similar things. You know, what would I ask people if I were in their presence? I would just try to, I think I would try to just develop a one-to-one relationship with him first, ordinarily, you know, just instead of going right into questions about his motivations for unleashing a world of terrorism for more than it already is. I would just try to understand on a human level if he thought that his twin daughters would be immune from all of the environmental problems that he's unleashing. I just would try to get a sense of how people in such power are absolutely insane but manage to pass.
Author and political satirist Paul Krassner. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.